The long-term survival of the human race is at risk, as long as it is confined to a single planet. Sooner or later, disasters such as an asteroid collision or nuclear war could wipe us all out. But once we spread out into space and establish independent colonies, our future should be safe. There isn't anywhere like the Earth in the solar system. For that, we have to go to another star.
That was superphysicist Stephen Hawking, the disabled discoverer of black holes in space, speaking through his voice machine. As the nearest star is 60,000 years away using current rocket technology, we may have to look after the planet we have. This is Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM, co-op radio in Vancouver, and broadcast live by cable, satellite, and the Internet. As World Cup races are cancelled in Europe due to lack of snow in the warmest early winter in more than 1,000 years, today we ask the question, is there a future for skiing and snowboarding? Will there be snow for the 2010 Winter Olympics in Whistler? With accelerating climate change, will our grandchildren see snow at all? Then we'll travel to the islands time forgot, the Galapagos, with CFRO's resident expert Mary Lee Stevenson. Those are the islands of strange creatures which inspired Darwin's theory of evolution. We'll round out the hour with an intense warning from one of the world's top biologists, Harvard's E.O. Wilson. He tells us about the sixth great extinction, not in a past age, but right now on Earth. First, a few notes from our own yearning to survive. A research farm at the University of British Columbia is experimenting with intense small-scale agriculture that produces not just food, but also the energy required to grow it. It's often a real debate in today's agricultural world whether the amount of energy and oil and natural gas for the fertilizers actually adds up to more than the energy we get for our bodies from the food that's produced. Well, there's an interesting experiment at the University of British Columbia Experimental Farm. We hear from Mark Bomford in an interview with Julian Darley of Global Public Media about the latest developments at the farm, where they try not only to raise food for people, but also the energy required for that farm. There's a lot of human-powered machinery being developed and a lot of great ideas that we could hear about. You can get the full interview, whether in video form or as an audio download, an MP3, at www.globalpublicmedia.com.
There's always been a farm at the University of British Columbia, and the way the farm has looked has changed dramatically over the last 80 years, particularly because it's been marginalized every time that there's been a campus development. The farm has been moved further and further away from the center of campus, and it's kind of matched the priorities that agriculture has taken in society over those years as well. So we've had this kind of marginalization of agriculture and food and society in general, and it's been almost completely mirrored by how the farm has moved on campus. So the farm we're on right now is basically UBC Farm version 4. And what we're attempting to do is to make a working farm system, make it a highly interdisciplinary place where we continue with the traditions, the academic traditions, of providing teaching and research, but also to maintain a strong community component. So it's a place where not just academics do their work, but the entire community is welcome.
And did you know that London is really the capital of the carbon barons? Here's the story of a walking tour opera that tells all.
We're going to walk together through the web of institutions that extract oil and gas from the ground, feeding the global economy, fueling our lives, releasing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. I will take you to fund managers, banks, insurance companies, lawyers, advertising agencies, and recruitment agencies. This web of companies I call the carbon web.
That's a clip from a new walking tour through the city of London in England, and it's really set as a kind of opera about climate change and London as the capital of the oil empire of the world. Now, you're used to having walking tours showing various ruins and items of interest in famous cities, but this one takes a little bit of a different turn. You end up going through British Petroleum headquarters, and you get to see the sort of bond trader markets where people are trading away the future of the world through more carbon emissions. And you might say, well, London, the oil capital of the world, what about Dallas or perhaps Dubai? But in fact, most of the world's oil trades are financed and organized through trading in London, England, as we hear now.
So London is stage managing world consumption of oil and gas?
Absolutely. Totally. If we, you know, it's easier sometimes to see these things in retrospect. For example, we now understand that you know, Manchester was one of the great cotton cities of the world. South Wales was the great one of the great coal mining areas of the world. It's very difficult for us to recognise, because we're so close up to it, that this is one of the great oil and gas extraction cities of the world. It's not written on their billboards. You don't see it. You don't see it in the way you see the coal mines in South Wales. But this is really where oil and gas is extracted from the ground. Not physically, obviously, there aren't drilling rigs. But all the financing, all the logistics, all the organising is done very strongly through this city. It's more important than New York, more important than Houston. And we have to wake up and understand that.
BP, the second largest oil company in the world, and the largest company in the UK, the driver of the world's oil economy. Its products emit twice the amount of carbon dioxide as all the citizens of the UK put together.
You can get more details about the opera and the walking tour called And While London Burns at www.platformlondon.org, or you can download it free as an MP3 at www.andwhilelondonburns.com. I can just imagine a video tour showing our own hidden carbon outlets, the coal port at Roberts Bank, those little sheds where giant pipelines pop up, the Burnaby Tank Farm. We could have a tour bus to show off our carbon shadow, the infrastructure that helps us cook the world. Here's some fun media activism. You know, the folks at RAN, the Rainforest Action Network, have been pushing GM and Ford to get some more fuel-efficient vehicles on the road. Well, the new president of GM, Rick Wagner, just gave a speech at the LA Automotive Show about how fuel-efficient some of the new vehicles coming out of General Motors can be. And at the end of his speech, two very fine-looking young men in suits got up to thank him for his speech. It looked like it was part of the program. And then they brought out a great big sign with a pledge that he could sign, saying that GM would make the most fuel-efficient vehicles in the industry by 2010. Of course, it wasn't part of the program. It was an action by RAN, and most of the folks there were taken in for a little while until the two men were pushed off the stage and the CEO sort of rushed away without having the planned question and answer period. Way to go, RAN, and too bad GM won't sign the pledge to make themselves the most fuel-efficient company by 2010. You can find out more at www.ran.org or watch the video there. See for yourself.
Thank you.
That was a really great speech. We really want to commend Mr. Wagner for a very inspiring speech. It's always great to see an automaker who's willing to take a strong stance on energy and environmental issues. And I have with me today a pledge for Rick to sign here, committing General Motors to become the leader in fuel economy by 2010. Rick, could you do us the honor?
I think my speech spoke for itself, but I appreciate your support.
I'm sorry you have to leave now. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks so much for coming, folks. Thanks so much for coming. We had planned a Q&A, but we're running a little late in time. We've got to get all the way over to the south.
Well, let's fire up that 4x4 and head out to the mountains for a little snowboarding while we still can.
International ski racing officials yesterday canceled two more European events. The reason? Not enough snow. Also scrapped, next month's men's downhill and super combined races in Val d'Isère, the famous French Alps resort. They're the latest on a growing list of weather-related cancellations. Worried ski racers and officials are wondering whether their sport is becoming a victim of global warming.
After the wettest November on record, and that's saying something for a rainy city, Vancouver was hit with a dump of snow, so everything looks hunky-dory for a nice white winter. But it isn't so in Europe, where national ski races and international World Cup ski races have been cancelled due to lack of snow in the European mountains, and the Europeans are placing the blame straight on climate change. We have several reports here for you. First of all, we're going to listen to an NPR, a National Public Radio, short broadcast on the current condition and the latest reports from the New York Times. That will be followed by an interview from Air America Radio with Betsy Rosenberg with the owners of Aspen and how Aspen is coping with climate change. And we'll follow up with a spokesman from Whistler Blackcomb, who will tell us what they are doing about climate change and how they think they will be faring for the 2010 Olympics. This is NPR from December 1st, 2006.
International ski racing officials yesterday canceled two more European events. The reason? Not enough snow. Also scrapped, next month's men's downhill and super combined races in Val d'Isère, the famous French Alps resort. They're the latest on a growing list of weather-related cancellations. Worried ski racers and officials are wondering whether their sport is becoming a victim of global warming.
Scanning the event schedule on the International Ski Federation website is like checking the departure monitor at an airport shut down by stormy weather. Races in Austria, Switzerland, Norway, Italy. Cancelled, 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 cancelled. Not enough snow, too much rain, and warm temperatures in Europe have officials scrambling to find alternate race sites, and racers like American Stephen Nyman asserting that Europe is just part of a global climate problem.
We travel around to Chile, and we're deep in the Andes, and we see these glaciers every year, and we, even being there for 3-4 years, can watch them deplete. Like they're going away, and it's very scary because our love is on the snow.
During a teleconference this week, Nyman was asked whether he thinks the European race cancellations are related to global warming. Definitely, he said. Climatologist Dr. Klaus Walter is a bit more measured.
It's contributing, it's sort of the backdrop, but we're not going to have ski race cancellations and warm falls like this every year.
Because there are other factors at play, says Dr. Walter, who works at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Without getting too technical, there have been, over the past 10 years, natural climate variations specific to Europe. High-pressure systems over the continent have led to warmer summers and falls, says Dr. Walter, but also colder winters, which usually start right about now. If that trend continues and Europe gets some snow, the racing circuit might be able to recover from the current upheaval. Meanwhile, the climate crisis appears to be recasting the ski-hard, party-harder image of alpine ski racers. On the teleconference, Ted Ligety sounded more conservationist than 2006 Olympic gold medalist.
Just bought a new furnace. It's 98% efficient, so, I mean, that's a big improvement over most ones that are 70% or whatever. So, I mean, that's big. And then, I mean, just conserving energy around the house, turning off lights, and not just putting the heat on your house at 75 degrees, I mean, little things like that can definitely help.
Stephen Nyman agreed that little deeds can be part of a bigger solution, but he also acknowledged that he and his peers may be part of the problem.
We're staying in hotel rooms, changing the linens, we're flying here and there, and we're driving everywhere. Like, we are using amazing amounts of fuel and resources. World travelers, that's a big part of the whole global warming issue.
Of course, canceling races helps cut down on travel. It also threatens skiers' livelihoods. And late yesterday, the immediate outlook was bleak. A plan to relocate some of the canceled European races to Colorado fell through because organizers couldn't raise enough money to put on the events. The irony of that decision? There's easily enough snow. Winter storms have dumped tons of it on Colorado over the past week. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Here we listen to a clip from Betsy Rosenberg's Air America program called EcoTalk. It's a fabulous green program that airs daily on Air America. You can find excerpts from the program on their blog at ecotalkblog.com. Really recommend it. Betsy is talking with Auden Shambler, the expert at the Aspen Skiing Company, the premier company at Aspen.
Well, to answer the question, have we seen the impacts of climate change? There are several studies that are out, scientific studies by some of the best scientists in the field of climate study, and they are showing that our snowpack is going down, our rates of precipitation are dropping, our nighttime and daytime temperatures are increasing. All those studies are available at a website, savesnow.org, and they're all on the bottom of that page. And today, in the New York Times, there's an article that's titled, Changing Climate is Forcing World Cup Organizers to Adapt. And what's amazingly interesting about this is that San Moritz, which is the cradle of skiing probably on the planet, doesn't have enough snow to host the World Cup in December. And temperatures have been too high for them to make snow. So they may have to move the World Cup to, of all places, Aspen, which actually still has snow because we're higher than San Moritz.
And you recently filed a Friends of the Court brief on behalf of the state of Massachusetts. Does that have anything to do with what is beginning this week in the U.S. Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's the lawsuit. To back up on that, we started saying, look, let's say we eliminated all the emissions at the ski resort. Actually, let's say we eliminated all the emissions in the entire ski industry. It wouldn't really matter. The climate would still be changing. The ski industry is a really small player in global climate emissions.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, if we really care about change, we're going to have to get politically active, and we're going to have to start using Aspen, which you know is a name that is recognized all over the place, as a lever to drive change. And so that's why we got involved with this Supreme Court case, which is probably the most important environmental lawsuit ever to go to the Supreme Court. And it's basically asking the EPA to regulate CO2, the primary greenhouse gas, as a pollutant.
So what about Whistler Blackcomb and the upcoming Olympics? Earlier, before he headed out onto the hills, I spoke to Arthur DeJong, who's been the ski patrol manager and the operations manager, and now he's the mountain planning and environment resource manager for Whistler Blackcomb.
The reason I phoned you this morning, this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. I do an environment program for CFRO 102.7 Co-op Radio in Vancouver. And I've been listening to radio reports from the United States, in particular an interview with a gentleman who runs the Aspen Complex, talking about his concerns about climate change and about the availability of snow in the future for ski resorts. And at the same time, as we know in Europe, a couple of the World Cup ski races have been canceled due to lack of snow and an unusual season over there. So I was going to ask you about Whistler Blackcomb's policy on climate change. What are your feelings? Do you think this is going to affect the ski industry?
Well, certainly, I guess to give the macro or big picture perspective, if I was having coffee with Kofi Annan this morning and asked him of the UN, what are the two most important things to focus on with respect to sustainability? His answer would probably be, well, let's first try to resolve global poverty, and number two, we'd better do something about climate change, or the world as we know it will likely be considerably different by mid-century. So we take climate change very, very seriously here at Whistler. This isn't something that's new on our agenda. Glaciers, which we have a number of surrounding the Whistler Blackcomb area, have been receding for over a century. And glaciers are the most sensitive ecosystem to temperature change. Essentially, they're nature's thermometer. So we've known for a long time that the climate has been warming, and consequently, we've been developing programs to both mitigate and adapt to climate change. So we've been preparing for this for several decades.
And I understand, just from looking at your website, that you've been undertaking some efforts to hold on to a glacier or two that you've got already?
That's correct. Horseman Glacier, which is part of our summer operations, believe it or not, we're skiing up to 10 months a year here. The Horseman Glacier has been receding like other glaciers in the area, and we've actually engineered, we have yet to be put in a position where we have to do it, but we have engineered a snowmaking system that would feed the accumulation zone or the top of the glacier to a degree that we could actually grow the glacier should we be required to. And one of the inputs we'd love to put into that system is to power it through wind generation, so essentially we can close the loop, and it's a completely sustainable operation, growing back a glacier. But that's a bit of a science project. The bigger picture is, again, that climate change is here, and we need to do a number of actions to ensure our long-term viability as a ski area. So we've been investing considerable money into snowmaking, particularly at our lower elevations. That's where we are vulnerable. And over the next 3 years, we'll be spending over $25 million on snowmaking, and again, principally focused on the lower elevations. In terms of development, we've been placing our lifts more into our higher elevations. Despite the Whistler Valley being quite low in elevation, over 50% of Whistler Blackcomb's terrain is above treeline, above 5,500 feet. So we have a lot of opportunity to move more of our lifts into what we call the snow belt. And even 20, 30 years from now, there'll still be very significant snowpacks at those elevations. The third thing that we are focused on with respect to adapting to climate change, because we as a company cannot change the course of climate change, but we need to do our part in terms of mitigating, but again, adapting. We spend a lot of time in the summers doing what we call summer grooming, essentially making our ski runs, trails, flatter, profiling it in a way that we only require, let's say, 30 centimeters of snow to open a trail as opposed to a meter.
And one other thing they mentioned at Aspen is that they're actually now letting their guests know that climate change is upon us, and they're setting up a Save the Snow website, I believe. And you do have some powerful and influential people come skiing at your resort as well. Are you going to let people know about climate change through the skiing experience?
Absolutely. We already are, being that we have glaciers within our operating area and surrounding us. It's the best testimony. A picture is 1,000 words, and we can show our guests, look at what climate change is doing. When we can show what the size of a glacier 30 years ago and the size of what it is today, and it's reduced a footprint, that's when the lights turned on. So we have this opportunity to be an advocate of enactment for climate change. But I think what is most important for Whistler Blackcomb is that we first show our guests, our community, and society at large what is possible in terms of reducing our fossil footprint. So we have a number of programs where we are what we call grabbing the low-hanging fruit, just simply changing our light bulbs to energy-efficient bulbs, putting timer sensors through all our facilities so we're only using energy when we need it, using the most fuel-efficient engines on our snow-grooming fleet. We've been able to, just with good European Mercedes technology, we've reduced our fossil fuel consumption by 18% on all our snow grooming cats. And there's a number of technologies out there today that can help us reduce our footprint. And I think that's the best way of addressing the issue to the guest, is making them aware of the issues, but also showing that change is possible. So we need to be not only an educator, but a change agent.
You were telling me you have a couple of micro-generating projects going.
This is very important to us because we want to show other companies and society that it's possible to turn a corner quick on using cleaner energy. So we are working on a wind farm. At this point, we're just putting MET towers up to the meteorological towers to verify whether we have the wind supply available to economically be able to build a wind farm. One project that's much closer to reality is a micro-hydro project in a river called the Fitzsimmons, which essentially flows between Whistler and Blackcomb. And it has the power availability, or the water supply, rather, to produce what we consume as an operation. So it's about an $18 million project. It produces about 32 gigawatts annually. And that could happen within 18 months. The engineering is already in place. It is viable. So if we're able to bring that project to fruition, we're really demonstrating to our guest and to our community and society that a company, an operation, can quickly become sustainable within its own operating footprint. So we're excited about that. We certainly have some work ahead to get that done.
Well, that's the way we all have to go. And finally, I guess the big question on everyone's lips in the Lower Mainland area is, will there be snow for the 2010 Winter Olympics?
Absolutely, absolutely. Climate change, like science, is based on long-term trends. If you look at Whistler today, it looks like mid-January here, we're at about 1.7 meters of snowpack, but that's weather. The science, in terms of what the global science community has told us, is that the real threats are long-term, and by mid-century, unless society at large makes significant changes in our consumption behavior with fossil fuels, that's when we as a global community really start to run into trouble. And that's quite a ways out. The Olympics are 3 years away, so we're in good shape there.
So keep on skiing.
Keep on skiing.
All right. Well, thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
You can find out more about this resort's environment policy at whistlerblackcomb.com. You're listening to Radio EcoShock every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
Well, when it's sort of cloudy or it's dark and it's wet, we all wish we could go somewhere exotic, and someone who's done that is Mary Lee Stevenson, who's just come back from the Galapagos not too long ago. Can you tell us, for our listeners, what and where are the Galapagos Islands?
Okay, where they are is on the equator. They're owned, in fact, by Ecuador, which is equator. And if you looked at a map of South America, the bulge to the left, the furthest bulge, is Ecuador, and then straight out, 600 miles to the west, are the Galapagos Islands. And what they are is a combination of volcanic ones, you know, that volcanoes have come up above the surface of the ocean, or in some cases they're uplifted where, you know, plate tectonics or whatever have, where one plate has slipped under the other and raised another one, you will get some of the islands are that way, which are characteristically flat surface, but then tilted slightly, as opposed to the sort of conical-looking ones.
Well, Charles Darwin raised them to international fame as sort of a laboratory of evolution, if you will.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But what do you find it like when you visit there today?
Well, this is my seventh visit, and that's because not only do I love it, but I did write a guidebook to the Galapagos. I have to say it's from Mountaineers Press. And when you go there, it's changed a great deal over the years. I was first there in about 1980. When you go there, let me just say, on a ship. You'll fly, but then you'll be on a boat, a sailboat, a motorboat, in my case this time, a small cruise ship. And it's just so... Really, it is just so exotic. And what you find there, would have to figure this out, Alex, in terms of whether you want to talk about, of course, the tourism-type things or the islands themselves. What would you like to start with, or how would you like to go about that?
Well, I'd like to start with the islands themselves. You know, a lot of my programming covers the terrible things that are happening to nature, but we don't hear enough about the nature, the intriguing mm-hmm. varieties that mm-hmm. there are.
Yeah. Well, let's see. The first thing I think to bear in mind is that it is, of course, in the equator, and that means that the seasonality is not pronounced. You know, what you have is more or less a rainier or moister season, not so much rain, but what they call garua, which is just high overcast clouds and a sort of mist effect, and then otherwise just really bright, uncovered kind of situation.
I'm picturing striking lizards or something like that. Do you see these wild...
Oh, absolutely. It is it is largely, that's the way to look at it, it's largely arid to semi-arid, okay? But because some of the islands, a few of them, have the volcanic cones or mountains that go up to 6,000 feet, then you get a lot of vegetation. Because, of course, if you're 600 miles out in the ocean, you know, you don't get the kinds of microclimates we have, or, you know, we've got here our wet coast and we've got the drier interior. Out there, it's largely would be a desert effect, but because some of it's higher, and as air rises, it cools and you get condensation. So once again, you get vegetation. But when you ask about the lizards and stuff like that, it's very famous for the iguanas, for sure, is what you're thinking of. They're almost a sort of totemic animal, them and the blue-footed boobies. But yes, not only do you have iguanas there, you have these marine iguanas, which swim in the ocean. They're about the size of a dachshund with a longer tail, some of them, the grown ones. They will swim and feed on underwater on algae and things like that, and then come up, because they're cold-blooded animals, they'll come up and sit by the dozens or hundreds, whatever, to warm themselves. And so you'll be walking by some rocks on a trail, and, you know, you're always guided by their licensed guides. You'll be walking along, and there will be marine iguanas. And in some of the islands, they have land iguanas, which are about the good-sized ones, about the size of what would be, say, they probably weigh 30, 40 pounds. They tend to be sort of yellow-green, and they just live in the sort of desert conditions, and they eat the cactus, the prickly pear cactus. And so, yes, you're right there with them. The bird life also is a fascinating part. You know, Darwin particularly found useful the fact, or as his ideas developed, the fact that from island to island, and I should say there are about six very large islands, one of which on the left, Isabella, is 100 miles or so north to south. There's six of those, about 14 mid-sized ones, and dozens of little islets and stuff. So he realized, and people also pointed out to him, that the finches in particular, and basically you think of just sparrow-looking, you know, dull-looking birds, they were different from island to island in terms of what they looked like and what their habits were. Okay, and so that's one of the things that's so distinctive about the place, because not only are the islands overall rather isolated, and for a long time didn't have too much in the way of natural enemies till the last 400 years or so, not only the islands, but each island from one to the other is. So if you're a finch, if you're a sparrow-type bird, you don't travel terribly far from one island to the next. You may get wind-blown, but there's a tendency then for them to evolve in ways that will then match what's there, you know, the cactus finch or the woodpecker finch that'll use, you know, little prongs of the cactus to probe into things because it doesn't have a real woodpecker bill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same way he noticed, or people pointed out to him as well, that the tortoises, and we distinguish that turtle tends to mean your sea turtles, okay, and they travel all around. But the tortoises, however, well, there's things about how they got there. But the tortoises then were different island to island. Some of them, the classic ones, have what they call a saddleback kind of shell, which is sort of pinched behind their neck. And so they're the ones that reached up very, very high. You know, they can reach up because of the neck and because of the way the shell is pinched up like that. They can feed 3 and 4 feet off the ground, while you have other ones that are just completely round-domed, and they tend more to sort of graze just low. I'm putting it extremely simply, but still, they were different from island to island, and that those kinds of things made him think about how the relationship between sort of genetic evolution and the connection with the environment and how you adapt it, you know, to the local situation over many, many years.
Something we all need to think about.
Yeah, that's right. We need a new turtle shell, too.
And how is this, is the area protected internationally?
Oh, yes. It's been a national park since 1934, but the real protection, which means also money, willingness, wherewithal, really, I would say, kicked in really in the 70s, when you get right down to it. I couldn't give you there's not an exact date, but about, on the islands, there's only two or three islands that have people living on them. And the main islands of those two, Isabela and Santiago, Santa Cruz, they actually have parts that are designated, for instance, agricultural. Okay, like in Santa Cruz, there's a whole wedge of the island, and there have been people farming there for 100 years or more. Okay, but so it's clearly designated what's agricultural, what's urban, really, in the small couple of small towns, and then what is preserved. And recently, by the way, only the last two or three years, I think, they also then declared the marine environment, I think about 100 miles or 100 kilometers out, around each island, these are also now protected.
And was that because of overfishing or threats from poaching?
Fishing,
or?
Well, it's a combination of things, because there's a couple of things. It's a rich environment, both the land in its own way and the sea. So, yes, you had fishing, not only fishing from the mainland people would come, but then local people fished as well. And so there were several problems with that. One is, I don't know if you call it overfishing or just plain fishing, but then with that, when there were fires, maybe it was fishermen who came on shore, rested, did themselves a little campfire, and boom, several years ago, tremendous problem with that. You get sort of a brush forest fire that just goes on and on and on. So essentially, the fishing was a problem, but I think more than, my sense would be almost more than anything, it was the activities associated with it.
And we're not talking about a place with hotels and beaches kind of destination. People really go there for the nature, don't they?
They go there for the nature. Some people, they go there and they clearly don't have the faintest idea what and why they're going there, mind you. But there are, by the way, hotels, yes. In Puerto Ayora, the main city of the whole place, it's got, what, about 25,000 people by now? Hmm. And they have real hotels. Some of which they're not large. You're not looking at your high rises or anything like that. But some of them very pleasant. Some of them little sort of seedy campovers because, you know, people, maybe even sort of student types, will be able to fly over. And then they'll wander around town. They'll maybe take day trips because there's a whole little sub-industry in tourism of day trips from the island. But most people, you come there, you fly there. You then are from the very nice airport now, a modest one, but it used to be just a pit. But now it's very, very pleasant. Your boat people will meet you. Say you're on, again, a boat for 12 people, or in the case, as I say, this time I was on a celebrity cruise, actually. They meet you, and then you take a quick little bus ride, and then on, Zodiacs are big. You know, they call them pangas as far as your sort of transport boat goes. But you hop on that, and then you go to your mother ship or your mother sailboat, and you live on that. Typically, it's an 8-day, 7-night trip. Okay, so you live on that. Some of them are very, very luxurious. And then in the morning, you have breakfast, and in the morning after breakfast, you hop on your panga. And there's one naturalist, and they're all trained and licensed by the national park, okay, by the Darwin station there. Then there's 8 or 10 people per naturalist. And you will then go maybe a 5-minute ride or maybe a 10-minute ride to one of the islands and hop off. And then you're very carefully, you are controlled, and I think rightly, there's clearly marked paths. And you go along those paths, and you'll do that in the morning, and they'll explain, here's where the boobies are, here's where you can see right here, right in front of you, Alex, the wave albatrosses and maybe their babies there, whatever. You come back for lunch, take it easy. The boat may then go from one place to the next, and then you'll hop on your panga again. So typically you have a morning and afternoon. But hotels, yes, there are some, and there's a lot of tourism shops, a lot of T-shirts in the town or two.
And what is the title of your book, and how can people get a hold of it?
Okay, it's called The Galapagos Islands, The Essential Guide to Travel, blah, blah. And what they could do is they could Google it. They can go to Amazon or Mountaineers Press, Mountaineers Books. It's just out of Seattle. Your best bet, because there was a second edition quite recently, your best bet is to go to your bookstore. Because it's American publisher and not a huge circulation, they may not carry it, but they can readily get it at anywhere. And Stevenson, I'll just say, is spelled S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S-O-N, Mary Lee Stevenson. And in any bookstore who has any kind of standard ordering thing could get it for you very quickly.
Well, thank you. We've been taking a tour of the Galapagos Islands with Mary Lee Stevenson, and it's been great talking with you.
You too, Alex. I appreciate it so much.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
Join us every Friday at 1 o'clock on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver.
We're now in a high-risk situation over so much of the world in terms of causing Earth's biodiversity to plummet down overall to 50% species by the end of the century.
The granddaddy of Earth biodiversity, E.O. Wilson, 1 in 8 plants are threatened. Half of land animals and most of large ocean species may disappear during our children's lives. We are coming to the greatest mass extinction ever known, including historic meteor strikes. The very fabric of living creation that populates our planet and our life experiences is going to gone.
The average extinction rate before humanity came along was one species, paleontologists tell us, one species per million species per year. And the average extinction rate was that. I'm sorry, that was the average extinction rate, and the average birth rate was that as well. So there was a kind of a balance. Now we have upped the extinction rate to the most conservative figure is 100 times over base level. And almost certainly it is order of magnitude 1,000 times. And I would expect that the more we learn, and certainly the farther the process continues into the 21st century, it will soon be order of magnitude 10,000 times. So a common figure used by some pretty somber and careful experts on this subject is that the Earth, the number of species on Earth could be cut in half by the end of this century.
Have your pen or keyboard ready. In a minute, I'm going to give the net address for the web's largest collection of information on mass extinction. There you can find hundreds of stark warnings in major media about the Great Extinction. Near the end of the broadcast, you'll get an important web address to find really recent reports on the state of the world by top scientists in lectures to the Harvard Medical School.
You can remember what are the agents of extinction with the word hippo. You know, like animal, hippo, with the order of the order of importance from the first letter on. The most important cause of species extinction is habitat destruction, H, habitat destruction. Second most important, invasive species. Then P for pollution, P for overpopulation. We have to sort of slip that in because, you know, it's the root cause. I mean, I grant that. A big part of the root cause. And then O, over-harvesting. And that does eliminate species. Humanity does destroy species by totally taking it out.
In 2004, Nature magazine reported from a scientific study that 1/4 of all animals and plants living on land could disappear forever. Millions of species may be extinct by 2050. One report reads, at a 2005 conference, renowned scientist Professor Peter Raven, director of the Missouri Botanical Garden, told delegates that without a change in current directions, as many as 2/3 of the world's species could be on the route to extinction by the end of this century. He said, nature will reach sustainability on its own terms unless humans can change course. Another says, scientists estimate that human activity has accelerated natural extinction rates by as many as 1,000 times the normal rate. Over the past 500 years, in fact, scientists have recorded about 250 species extinctions among mammals, birds, amphibians, reptiles, and conifers. Today, the world stands to lose 3 times that amount in perhaps the next 10 to 50 years. According to a new scientific report by the Alliance for Zero Extinction, AZE, however, there is new hope for some of these most threatened populations, and still time to protect them. Conservation International, and 52 other like-minded organizations that comprise the AZE, conducted a global analysis to identify those endangered and critically endangered species that exist in a single remaining population and are largely confined to a single location. The AZE has identified 595 sites as the last remaining refuge of 794 species. In its December 2005 report, the AZE sets forth a blueprint to immediately safeguard key habitats and possibly prevent an imminent wave of species extinctions. That report came from Jennifer Shatwell of Conservation International. Okay, here's the web address you need to track the loss of living creations. www.well.com/user/DavidU, that's DAVIDU, /extinction.html. I'll repeat that. www.well.com/user/DavidU/extinction.html. Let's turn to a fantastic resource to educate yourself and others about our developing crisis. In February 2006, the Harvard Medical School organized a series of lectures on the environment, gathering preeminent speakers. It was all recorded on video. At the time of this report, most of the lecture series is still available to the public as a streaming video onto your computer. You can find the web address for the Harvard Medical School lectures on the environment, including the Wilson Lecture on Conservation and Biodiversity, at www.ecoshock.org/greatextinction/index.html. Edward O. Wilson is renowned for his research into living systems in many places of the world. He has journeyed to deep jungles and the distant edges of the earth to record the wealth of species. Wilson's particular specialty is ants.
As a kid, this is the back vacant lot next to our house in Mobile, Alabama. Monitoring the insects and trying to find out all of the different kinds of ants that lived in that area. And I found, it was my first scientific discovery, I found the first fire ant colony, imported fire ant colony from Uruguay and southern Brazil, recorded in the United States. And that has since spread from Mobile in all directions, from the Carolinas to Texas, now to the West Indies, California, China.
The granddaddy of Earth biodiversity, E. O. Wilson, speaking at the Harvard Medical School on February 16, 2006, a speech called Biodiversity and Conservation.
The species, the diversity in these forests really is legendary. From this canopy of Peru alone, I took identified 42 species of ants living there in 23 genera. And that's approximately equal in size to the entire known ant fauna of the British Isles. One tree.
In addition to his research, Wilson is a longtime teacher at Harvard University and a much-published author of books with a contagious sense of wonder and love for nature. He has won 2 Pulitzer Prizes and many other awards. One of my listeners, hearing a sense of despair, knowing that human life is causing mass extinctions, sent me a book that brings her hope. It was called The Future of Life by one Edward O. Wilson, published in 2002. Essentially, he argues that humans, all of us, are born with an instinctual love for other life forms. We are not mental islands, but part of a vast network of living things that support, comfort, and inspire us. He calls that love for nature biophilia. If our instinctive love for nature, our biophilia, can take a leading role, Wilson believes we can get through this difficult century, coming out with a livable planet. Here is one example of his optimism, this time about population.
I think the 21st century is going to be known as a century of the environment. It's useful to employ the metaphor of the bottleneck. We're in a bottleneck. Humanity is in a bottleneck, which is due to the still rapidly increasing population of the Earth and, of course, rising per capita consumption. And our goal should be to get through that bottleneck, come out the other end with a decent standard of living for all, environmental stability, and having brought through as much of the rest of life with us as possible. To me, that is a great goal of the 21st century. Because if you can achieve those two great goals, then you'll be achieving a great deal else of what humanity thinks of as its noblest goals. There is some hope that we actually will make it through that bottleneck, in spite of the understandable pessimism of so many people. One of them is that we are approaching an end to the population explosion. It turns out that when women are liberated, are empowered, and have control of their own lives, including their reproductive lives, and some hope for their own future, the fertility rate plummets. And it has correspondingly plummeted in the last 40 years from about 6, this is globally, 6 per woman, 6 children per woman, to 3 per woman. The break point is 2.1 children per woman, and that is the 0.1, of course, is the insurance. That's you have to have that 0.1 for cover child mortality. And all the European, Western European countries, I mean Eastern as well, are now below breakpoint, and the lowest, I believe, the figure I've seen is 1.1 or 1.2. The lowest is Italy. And several of the European countries are now in negative population growth. And it's the trend is now popping up in the Asian tigers, the economically rapidly advancing Asian countries, including, surprisingly, maybe not to people who've been there, but surprisingly, Thailand. So the best figures are, the ones I'm aware of, from the United Nations Population Services, is that we will peak on the present trends at about 9 billion per year, 9 billion total standing population by the end of the century. And then we'll start coming down. And that being kept in mind, there's not much, too much to hope that this planet can be turned into a paradise.
Wilson is one of the major proponents of a scheme to purchase the last great areas of biodiversity to preserve an estimated 70% of the land species of Earth. For around $28 billion, some protective institution could buy the biologically richest rainforests in the Amazon, the Congo, and Indonesia, and perhaps rare islands of species in places like Madagascar.
It's the Ark of Eden.
To put the cost in perspective, the profits of the American oil companies were $100 billion in 2005. Just one quarter of that money could save creations that evolved over a billion years. Once they're gone, they're gone.
When it's gone, it's gone. When it's dead, it's dead. Put it in a book called history. That's all she wrote, she said.
But like most of us, Wilson's optimism is darkened by doubts about the future of such rapacious reproducers, the humans. He trusts that life will survive with or without us. He finds life everywhere, always.
Everywhere there is liquid water, or the potential of liquid water, pole to pole, from the summit of Everest to the Challenger Deep at 36,000 feet below the ocean surface. At the very least, there are bacteria and usually microscopic fungi present. With microscopic fungi, that's a really interesting suite of organisms. They turn up everywhere. There are microscopic fungi in Lake Vostok, the deep subterranean lake that's been isolated for into the order of a million years by the Antarctic ice shelf. There are bacteria there, we now know, and microscopic fungi. There are microscopic fungi among the slimes. That's acronym for Subterranean Lithoautotrophic Microbial Ecosystem, SLIMES, fairly new to biology. Beneath the surface of the Earth and going down as much as 2 miles, a huge biomass of microorganisms. Bacteria, undoubtedly archaea, microscopic fungi, whose ultimate energy source is chemosynthesis of materials available in the subterranean deposits. They don't depend upon ultimate photosynthetically derived energy. And if the Earth's surface were burned off, then they probably would survive. And then after a few billion years, perhaps, reemerge as multicellular organisms, and plants and animals of a whole new creation, and finally something like us, and then the cycle would start all over again.
And don't trust in some magic cure by genetic science to make a new world. At their best and brightest, humans are not gods and cannot replace creation from the lab.
Now, we really have to start moving on this. I mean, humanity has to do better than it has been. It's begun to move in the right direction. It's got to be doing a lot better because the damage already done is irreparable. It cannot be repaired in any period of time that has meaning to the human mind. And the reason for this is that unless we can find a way to start creating artificial species and building artificial ecosystems, which in my mind would be an abomination, because then everything has to be filtered through the human mind and the human imagination, and the natural world is so much more interesting, so much more varied, so much more surprising, so much deeper in complexity than anything the human mind can at this time invent, this would be a terrible way of opting out, of taking action now to save what we have inherited.
Here again is the address for watching E.O. Wilson's important lecture and other lectures about the environment. http://chge.med.harvard.edu/education/course_2006/topics/02_16/index.html. Or you can download the full audio version from Radio EcoShock at www.ecoshock.org/greatextinction/index.html. For more news and science, tune in to Radio EcoShock, the world's only full-time all-environment radio station, at www.ecoshock.org. Tom Paxton's song came from the Rachel Carson tribute album at www.musemusic.org. Our closing music is by Earth Mama, the Grassroots album, at earthmama.org. Maybe, just maybe, we don't have to say goodbye to the frogs, the colored birds, the rich medley of plant life, the loved animals of our childhood. It's up to you.
Let's not say goodbye. Who's to say it's over? Beginnings can go on and on and on. We can do better by and by. Oh, please, no goodbye. Let's not say goodbye.
You've been listening to Radio EcoShock on CFRO 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Join us next Friday at 1 o'clock and tell your friends.